Talk about a bunch of ideas, only some of which are my own work, but I just wanted to mention at the beginning that the part of it that is my own work was done and published about 10 years ago in a ERL, and then just recently Chris Ealing, Raph Gudens, and I extended this work a little bit, and that's also now published. And I'll try in this talk to actually describe both the original idea and the new elaboration of it. I only have an hour to speak, so I can't go into all the details, but I hope the basic ideas will come across. So the starting point, and really, but not the ending point, is black hole entropy. So there's this amazing formula that the black hole, or Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, is 1/4 the area in Planck units, the Planck length squared, I'll just remind you, being h bar g over c cubed. It's a tiny length, the Planck length. And for everything I'm saying, that's really a crucial and a central point, that the Planck length that appears in this formula is just shorter than every other length scale that we deal with in physics. So it's got Planck's constant, and so that's quantum mechanics, and it has g, so that's gravity. This is some kind of a message from quantum gravity. Normally, entropy is the logarithm of the number of states of the system that we're talking about in statistical thermodynamics. So presumably, this is the log of the number of states, but we don't know what the states are yet because we don't understand quantum gravity. It's quite a strange situation that we know the answer to that question without even knowing what the theory is. And that's really the puzzle. Can we, so what is the message this is telling us from quantum gravity? Is there any hope of using this as a kind of springboard into the theory, or a way to see into that theory deeper than just the formula on the face of it? So that's the goal, that's the general question that's been posed. And the very first step is to realize, or to argue, that black hole entropy really has nothing to do with black holes fundamentally. It's really, we discovered it first in the context of black holes, but the actual thing we're talking about here is horizon entropy, not black hole entropy. So I'm claiming that, well, first of all, everybody knows, probably even if you're not anywhere close to this field, you've heard that a de Sitter, that is a cosmological horizon, also is understood, believed to have an entropy that's given by the exact same formula. And already that's a huge leap, because a black hole, if it's sitting there, is a kind of well-defined region of the space-time that every observer can agree on is there. That is, you don't have to select a particular observer to identify what you mean by the black hole horizon. But a de Sitter horizon is completely different. Not each observer, but there are many different de Sitter horizons in de Sitter space. Pick one inertial observer, and that one goes on for all time in de Sitter space and has a certain horizon. If you just move over to another spot and take another inertial observer, you have a different de Sitter horizon. So there's no objective de Sitter horizon sitting there in de Sitter space, and yet every one of them has this entropy, A, or entropy density, 1/4 the area over Planck length squared. But once you've made that leap, it seems inevitable, although psychologically apparently many researchers are not willing to make the leap, it seems inevitable that also an acceleration horizon, a Rindler horizon, has an entropy given by the same formula. It's a little uncomfortable because a Rindler horizon, an acceleration horizon, is of infinite area, so the entropy is infinite. But the point here is that it's really the entropy density that this formula tells us. It's 1/4 is the entropy density. Yes?
Would you explain why the black hole entropy extends to de Sitter entropy?
No.
Because I guess I'm not questioning that.
Okay. You can read this paper. So I just wanted to say the evidence for all of this is comes from many places. The first law of horizon, the first law of black hole thermodynamics generalizes to other horizons in strict analogy. as far as getting from a De Sitter horizon to a Rindler horizon, you can take the limit of zero cosmological constant, or you can consider a black hole horizon where the mass of the black hole goes to infinity, and locally, there can be no distinction between a little piece of a giant black hole horizon and an acceleration horizon, unless we have some mystical idea that a black hole is different. But physics is local, is the point of view of my talk, and really, I think, a sustainable point of view. So I believe that that argument is convincing. You can also, there's also evidence from calculations in semi-classical quantum gravity of pair creation rates for black holes, like in an external magnetic field, where the entropy you would associate with the acceleration horizon of the final and initial metrics comes into the calculation in just the way you would expect if the number of states available for the transition were reflected in to receive a contribution from the acceleration horizon entropy. And also you can look at transition rates for quantum systems like an Unruh detector near an acceleration horizon, and the transition rate also similarly to here is governed in a way that you would expect by the area change of the horizon. So all of these arguments are summarized in this review article that Renaud Parentani and I wrote called Horizon Entropy. And I guess really the main purpose of the article was to make the case, summarize the case for this claim. So I won't go into it in this talk, but that's where all the arguments I could possibly give you are located at the moment. So the starting point of this talk is that that's, well, I believe that's true, and so what are the consequences?
So, some of the properties of black hole horizons, like the membrane paradigm, does that also extend to Rindler horizons?
Yes, as you'll see. So, in fact, so the basic idea is to take this notion of black hole thermodynamics and localize it to not just any sort of globally defined horizon, but to a local notion of horizon around every point in space-time. So this is just supposed to be a summary of a look forward at the rest of the talk. I just want to put up there where we're headed. So I want to say that I invite you to think about any point in space-time setting up a two-dimensional plane at one instant through that point, and it really doesn't matter where the plane goes when you get far away from the point, and consider the boundary of the past, the causal past of that plane, and that boundary will be a null surface, and it will have a lot in common with a piece of an event horizon of a black hole, and I want to consider the thermodynamics of that horizon. And specifically, I want to consider a situation where, well, first of all, I'm going to think of that horizon just like we think of a black hole as a kind of heat bath, and that it has a universal entropy density per unit area, eta, so that the entropy is just the area times eta. And then I want to consider transitions where heat flows into the system. The heat is delta Q, and this is supposed to just indicate heat flowing across. And I'll make clear what heat means. It's basically energy appropriately identified. And according to a Clausius relation between heat and entropy change, dS is delta Q over T. This is really an expression, you know, in the foundations of thermodynamics of the second law of thermodynamics, the existence of an integrating factor for the heat flow that identifies that there exists a function, the entropy. Is really an expression of the second law. And so I'm just going to invoke that relation with delta Q appropriately identified as a form of energy. And T will be identified as the Unruh temperature of this local acceleration horizon. And what I want to show you is that these assumptions imply that, well, it's clear, they imply that the entropy changes and the entropy is proportional to the area must change. So the area must change in a way that's related to the energy that flows across the horizon. But that means that the area of this horizon can't be constant, first of all, even if it's constant up here at this point. So that means that the null geodesics that generate the horizon are focusing or bending. And the bending means that there's curvature in the space-time. And in particular, if we impose this condition for all such horizons everywhere in space-time, we can argue that it's only consistent if Einstein's equation holds. So Einstein's equation is a consequence of this Clausius relation, the area entropy density, and this identification of heat. Also, Einstein's equation has Newton's constant in it, whereas these two assumptions don't mention Newton's constant anywhere. So I have to tell you, what's the Newton constant that comes out? It's 1 over 4h bar times eta, the universal entropy density. So that's where we're headed. But before we jump onto the path of me giving you the details of the reasoning, I want to consider an analogy, which is more familiar and more transparent, which maybe is nice to keep in mind while we're looking at this case. The analogy is a situation in physics where there's also two length scales that are very different. In this case, there's this Planck length that I emphasized at the beginning, and the other long length scale might be, say, the radius of curvature of the space-time that Einstein's equation governs. And in the analogy, the analogy is gases. So back at the beginning of the 19th century, experiments with chemical reactions of gases showed that there are simple relations between the volume of the gases before a reaction and the volumes after. And from a number of experiments and theorizing, it was finally realized by Avogadro that the number of molecules is universally proportional to the volume of a gas at fixed temperature and pressure, which is quite an amazing thing if you think about it, that this macroscopic measurement of volume, pressure, and temperature tells you this microscopic number. And it's sort of analogous to how the black hole entropy is telling us macroscopically a microscopic number, the number of states of the quantum space-time, whatever it is. And just like we don't know what quantum space-time is, Avogadro didn't know what an atom was. He didn't know how a chemical reaction worked. He did have to figure out one thing for this whole scheme to work out, which I learned about recently. The scheme didn't work until he realized that many of the elementary gases were in fact composed of diatomic molecules. And only by realizing that the molecule could split, and that a gas of a given volume could turn into twice the volume just by splitting and still satisfy this relation that the number is proportional to the volume. Before he realized that, the scheme didn't work. And I've been reading recently his paper about this just out of fascination. It's really interesting that he had this insight. This is not relevant to my talk, but I just want to mention it. He realized it must be that these molecules are splitting. And then he immediately, deep insight, exactly right, and then he immediately made a mistake where he said, and they can not only divide, but you can also separate them, divide them again into 4 or 8 or 16. He immediately theorized that it was always a power of 2 that you could divide the molecule into. So he injected a theoretical idea about the microscopic theory that was irrelevant. He mentioned immediately, in my experience, I've only seen cases where I needed to take the division into 2 into account. Nevertheless, it could be into 4 or 8, etc. So it's really intriguing that the steps we take in science, which are profound, you know, really have to be small enough to be correct. And always, pretty much, we take too big a step, and then our colleagues have to that just tell us to forget everything except the first good idea. So, anyway, he got that right. Now we know, and people figured out shortly after that, that it's not just that the volume is proportional to the number at fixed pressure and temperature, but you know, if you change the pressure and temperature, there's other scaling relations that hold, and they're summarized in this equation of state that everybody knows for an ideal gas. And this accounts, well, like I just said, for the proportionality with V of V with N and much more. So I want to show you how you could derive this equation of state if all you knew was the entropy of the gas, a certain property, not even the entropy formula, a certain property of the entropy that you could get just from the fact that the molecules are tiny compared to the volume that the gas occupies. And this is going to be analogous to the fact that we're getting that the entropy of a horizon scales with the area just from the fact that the Planck length is so small and nothing else. So the molecules, here are the assumptions that lead to this. The molecules are tiny. The entropy is not only the entropy in thermodynamics, but it's Boltzmann's constant times the log of the number of states, the Clausius relation I just said before, and the fact that energy is conserved. Those assumptions imply this in the following way. So the fact that the molecules are so small, they occupy almost no volume, that means if we're counting up the number of states of n particles, it must be the volume to the nth power times some function of the energy that I don't know and need to know for this argument. This, I'm just saying, follows merely from this qualitative property that the molecules are tiny. So the entropy is k times the log of that. When I take the log, I get n log v plus some other thing. And this tells me that the partial derivative of the entropy with respect to volume is just nk over v. And that's all I need. As you probably already see, imposing the Clausius relation, and then energy conservation tells us that the heat that flows into the system is the change of its energy minus the work it does. And so expanding this, thinking of S as a function of energy and volume, this tells us that the partial derivative of entropy with respect to volume must be just P divided by T. That's it. But we just inferred from counting that, on the other hand, that same partial derivative is nk over v, and therefore pv equals nkt. So this logic is impeccable. It's incredible, actually, how much I think we learned from it, a simple fact about the smallness of the molecules. And that's exactly what I'm going to do to derive the Einstein equation as an equation of state from horizon entropy. Well, to get off the ground, we have to have a system in thermal equilibrium that we're going to apply the Clausius relation to. Where's the system? I'm just talking about empty space. The system is everywhere. So this is vacuum as thermal equilibrium. So here's a picture of one of these local acceleration horizons, the local Rindler horizons, and actually, the whole thing is modeled on flat space quantum field theory. So what I really want to do here is just remind you about, or explain to you if you never saw it, the Unruh effect in flat space quantum field theory. According to this effect, the vacuum of a Lorentz invariant quantum field theory looks like a thermal state when viewed from the point of view of an accelerating observer. And here's a sharp statement of what that means. So we take 0, 0, the projection onto the vacuum state of this field theory, and carve up space into left and right-hand wedges and trace over the left-hand side and form this density matrix rho right. That is a description of the vacuum as far as it could possibly affect any observable confined to the right-hand wedge. I haven't said anything about acceleration yet. I will later, but for now, it's just observables in the region are, from their point of view, the state is this mixed state density matrix. And the statement is that density matrix actually has the form of a thermal state, where the Hamiltonian H boost is the generator of the boost symmetry of Minkowski space around this point. That means the Lorentz transformations that leave this point, or really this plane, because I'm suppressing two dimensions, leave it invariant. So we could write it this way. TAB is the stress energy tensor for the field, whatever it is. I contract it with chi A, the Killing vector that generates this boost symmetry. Here I have a couple of flow lines of that Killing field. It's like a hyperbolic rotation around this point. So that's the current of boost energy. And then I compute its integral over a spatial surface sigma b. I didn't draw the spatial surface, but that's supposed to be just a slice here. And that's the generator of boost transformations on the quantum fields in the region R. So that's the Hamiltonian. And then T is just h bar over 2 pi. It's a kind of dimensionless temperature. The reason it's dimensionless is that, and doesn't have dimensions of energy, is that h doesn't have dimensions of energy. And that's because this is the generator of translations in the hyperbolic angle, rather than the generator translations in time. And so angle is dimensionless, and so the temperature is dimensionless when h bar is set to 1. So this is just a fact about Lorentz invariant quantum field theory in flat space. It was first proved in a different language by Bisignano and Vickman. It's essentially the same as the Unruh effect. The direct connection to the Unruh effect is the following. Suppose I'm an observer now here, a particular one, following this hyperbolic world line. That's an orbit of the Killing vector. So for me, everything is stationary along that line because it's one of the it's a flow line of the symmetry transformation of the space. And if I rescale the hyperbolic angle along here to match my proper time, then this temperature turns into a real temperature. It just gets scaled by, it turns out, the acceleration of my world line. So h bar acceleration over 2 pi is the local temperature of this state, and that's the Unruh temperature. And I'll need this in a second. If I measure the distance of this curve to this point on a straight line, I get a proper distance L, and it turns out the acceleration is just 1 over L. So the temperature goes like 1 over L. So if I take an extremely accelerated observer, the temperature goes to it, becomes very large. OK, and so that's a thermal state. So I can look at the vacuum in flat space around every point as a thermal state. It has this temperature, and it has entropy, because this is a mixed state density matrix. And I can write down the entropy minus trace rho riot plot rho. That's called the entanglement entropy of the vacuum. Yeah.
Is that the, what is that in the first line?
Which?
There's a big Z in the first line.
Oh, that's just to normalize this.
Normalization.
Z is the trace of
thermal thing.
Yeah. So what about this entropy? What is it equal to? Well, we can actually easily conclude that it's infinite. If we think of this as a thermal bath of massless radiation as one example, we know that the entropy density goes like temperature cubed. So integrating up all the entropy, I have to integrate by the volume element d area, that's the transverse area, and dl, the radial length from the horizon. And then putting in the fact that the temperature goes like 1 over the length cubed, I get, and the fact that nothing depends on the area, I bring out a factor of area, and I get a divergence, an ultraviolet divergence that's 1 over L squared. So the entropy is infinite if I include all of it, and it scales like 1 over the cutoff length squared. So since this entropy, or its analog outside the horizon of a black hole, must contribute to the budget of entropy for an observer that stays outside a black hole. And since a black hole has a finite entropy, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, it must be that this cannot be, we can't take the cutoff to zero, there must be a cutoff that makes this answer finite. Yeah.
Can you get back to the question that I raised before? So if you look at two-point functions in this state, then you see that they're not thermal in the usual Minkowski sense. For example,
they're precisely thermal in the sense that this state has this precisely thermal form.
right? If you, for example, calculate energy densities and pressures, then you don't find P equals 1/3 rho.
They're precisely thermal in the sense that the density matrix has a precisely thermal form with respect to the Hoost Hamiltonian. That's the only thing I'm asserting.
But is that enough to say thermal?
It's a maximum entropy. When you maximize the entropy at fixed Hoost energy, you get this density matrix. It's the Gibbs state. That's all I'm asserting. So once we accept that it must somehow be cut off, we don't know how yet, could it be that this is the source of all the black hole entropy? So remember, the black hole entropy went like area over Planck length squared. So it looks like maybe so. If the cutoff is the Planck length, then we get something of the right order of magnitude. On the other hand, there's a famous problem with this, often called the species problem. Of course, the entropy we get would depend on how many fields we have, and also on the details of how those fields interact. And so how could it possibly be, when we add them all up, we get exactly area over 4 Planck length squared? Well, it could be if it just so happened that the sum of all the L cutoff to the minus 2s, that is, if were to equal the Planck length to the minus 2. In other words, if the inverse renormalized Newton constant that enters the Bekenstein-Hopping entropy, in fact, were equal to the sum of these contributions. Okay, so that seems, it could be, but it seems like an artificial arrangement, perhaps.
Well, maybe it can happen, you know, the catalog would be somehow, like, presumably implemented dynamically, that if you reach a certain, you know, high energies, you start seeing the fall off of the element spectral function. But if you put lots and lots of fields in, maybe you can influence where the energy where this kind of happens.
Right.
It's not unthinkable.
Right. Well, in fact, that's the point of this slide, is that if we think about how does adding fields affect the value of the renormalized Newton constant, just at the level of the effective action. Of course, if you toss in another field into your theory, if you held everything else fixed, you'd get a new value of the renormalized Newton constant. And in fact, it was suggested by Suskind and Mouhon and myself, and checked in a beautiful quantitative calculation, first by Demers, Lafrance, and Myers, that in fact, this is a calculation in free field theory, where they tossed in some new kind of field, regulated this entropy with Talley-Villars regularization, and compared the contribution of that field to the renormalization of 1 over h bar g, compared that to its contribution to the entanglement entropy of the black hole atmosphere. They're thinking about black holes, not general horizons. They got, in fact, that precisely the contribution is a over 4 times the corresponding change in the renormalization of 1 over hg. So it's a very precise computational evidence in the context of free field theory on a background that this is true. In fact, they found more than that. They showed that the next order correction term to the effective action for gravity, which includes curvature squared terms, is also balanced by a lower order correction to the entanglement entropy of the corresponding field. So it's really quite impressive. So this gives the idea immediately that we could maybe maintain the idea that black hole entropy is nothing but horizon entanglement entropy, but only if somehow 1 over the bare Newton constant, whatever that is, were 0. Otherwise, we'd have a contribution from the bare gravity, and then all this sort of renormalization adding onto it. But if entanglement entropy is everything, we'd have to, in some sense, have 1 over the bare Newton constant be 0. Now, there is no real meaning, as far as I know it, to the bare coupling constant in a theory that's not renormalizable. And even if it is renormalizable, it might be that the bare coupling is 0 or something. I mean, it's not a concept we know how to handle in the way we do effective field theory. So I put it in quotes, but you get the idea that if somehow there were no contribution other than the entanglement, this goes under the name of induced gravity, then we would have this identification of entanglement entropy and black hole entropy. And the claim one claim I'd like to make is that thermodynamic reasoning, the one I'll show you now, actually implies that it must be this way. There is no choice but that the Newton constant we see at low energies is identified, in effect, with the entanglement entropy of all of the states that can influence us, that is, the ones that enter into the thermodynamic, the changes of entropy governed by the Clausius relation. So here's, now I'm going to the part where I'll actually try to show you more specifically how I infer the Einstein equation must hold, and with that particular value of Newton's constant. So this is just supposed to be a picture of a stationary black hole horizon. These lines are the null generators, null geodesics. Here's a light cone at one point. Here's a cross section of the horizon. It would be like a space-like two-sphere. And at a point on that horizon, just a little section of that two-sphere, I'm taking it out and drawing it over here. And in fact, picking an arbitrary point in the space-time, thinking of that as my equilibrium point, just like any point on the horizon of a black hole, drawing a space-like two-surface through that point, which on my picture appears as a one-surface, and then taking the boundary of the past of that on one side, and that's ruled by null generators, and that's my local horizon to which I will apply the Clausius relation. So it doesn't have the same symmetry that flat space has. So I don't have a boost Killing field with respect to which I can define a temperature precisely, the Unruh temperature. But all I really need to do is zoom in on the neighborhood of that point and use the fact that whatever the length scale of curvature in my space-time is, I can look more in a neighborhood of P that's much smaller than that length scale. And since the Planck length is so tiny, unless the curvature of the space-time starts to get near the Planck length, there's no obstruction to me looking at it this way. So I zoom in on this point, and now it's almost like flat space. And I have an approximate boost Killing vector field. And I can define heat flux across my horizon, just like using the boost energy current with the approximate boost Killing field. We've checked in our recent paper quantitatively that the ambiguities in chi don't affect this argument. So you can just do an expansion in Riemann normal coordinates around P and make the argument local that way. And I need one technical fact, that this boost Killing field on the horizon, it's a vector field that's going to point this way. I've oriented it so it's pointing towards P instead of away, and it's a null flow on this horizon. The boost Killing field flows up to the point P, and so it's parallel to the tangent vector K to the null generators of the horizon. So lambda here is an affine parameter along those null generators, and a crucial thing here is that I have minus lambda because I'm counting P as lambda equals zero. So to the past of P, I have negative lambda. And lambda is zero at the point P, so chi is zero there. And that's true. That's like the central point of a rotation Killing field where the Killing flow goes to zero. In other words, the fixed point of the Killing flow is P. And that means that actually an infinite amount of Killing time passes as I flow up to P. So P is my equilibrium point, and in terms of Killing time, it takes an infinitely long time to get to P. So things change very slowly with respect to Killing time. And it's in that sense that the world at P looks like an equilibrium configuration with respect to, and a thermal state with respect to the boost Hamiltonian at the Unruh, at the temperature H bar over 2 pi.
So I can follow this. Are you assuming that P is a bifurcation two-sphere, or are you...
P is a point. Through P, I draw an arbitrary two-surface. And then that two surfaces identified right with a, well, the tangent plane to that two surface at P is identified with the bifurcation plane of a, of the local ruler horizon. So yeah, it's exactly like the bifurcation plane. It's a point on the bifurcation plane. So now I'm just going to evaluate all the terms in the Clausius relation and deduce the Einstein equation. Maybe I should, I messed up my, okay, so delta S is delta Q over T. First I have to write down what, how do I evaluate the change in entropy? It's eta times the change in area. The change in area can be written as the expansion, the integral of the expansion times the affine parameter change times the area over the horizon. The expansion is just defined as derivative of the area element with respect to lambda divided by the area. So you see if I just put that in there, the area elements cancel, then I have a total derivative with respect to lambda, and that picks out the area change. It's called the expansion of the horizon generating LG basis. And delta Q is the integral of the boost energy current over the horizon. K d lambda dA is just the volume element on the horizon. And now putting in the formula I said before that chi is minus lambda K, this just becomes minus lambda stress energy tensor KK d lambda dA. Now, a crucial observation is that this is linear in lambda. So it goes to zero at the equilibrium point. That means there's no heat flowing into the system at the equilibrium point. And the rate of heat flowing in goes to zero asymptotically as you approach that point. If I compare this, if I impose delta S equals delta Q over T, and delta Q has an integrand that's linear in lambda, delta S better also have an integrand that's linear in lambda. So the expansion must vanish at the point P. I infer that the expansion must vanish at the point P. Now, how does the expansion behave? To evaluate this integral, I need to know theta as a function of lambda. And that's given by the focusing equation, often called the Rache-Hadoury equation, but I think it's actually not. I think he derived the analogous equation for the flow of a volume element. And this equation was written by Ray Sachs and also Newman and Penrose. Anyway, it's just an aside. So there's this equation that just follows from the geodesic equation for null geodesics, that the rate of change of the expansion along a flow of null geodesics is minus a half expansion squared, minus the shear squared, minus the Ricci tensor contracted twice with the tangent vector to the congruence. And since, as I just said, we have to satisfy the Clausius relation, the expansion must vanish at lambda equals zero. The first, if I make a Taylor expansion of theta around lambda equals zero, the first order term must be this one. There is no zeroth order term. And then there are corrections at order lambda squared. So this is what I should put into the integrand. So I do that here. Theta is minus lambda sigma sigma plus r. And as I said, T is going to be h bar over 2 pi, the unruh temperature. And now we've got all the ingredients, and we set them equal. Now, what does that mean? Remember that P could be any point in space-time. And also, once I pick the point, my two-dimensional plane, I could orient in any direction in space. So by changing the orientation of the plane and changing the point, if all of those integrals are going to be equal to each other, it must be that the integrands are equal. So I infer that this integrand must be equal to, or divided by t, must be equal to this integrand for all k's, for all orientations of the surface. That's not possible unless the shear vanishes. You can see why in the following way. Without changing k, I can change the shear by changing the derivative of k. And that amounts to a kind of distortion of the surface at P. If I take a plane in Riemann normal coordinates, then I'll have zero shear at P. But if I warp the plane in an astigmatic way, I can produce a shear at P without changing the value of K there. And therefore, I cannot satisfy this without killing off the sigma term. So this is part of our new work. When I first did this, I set sigma to 0 at p on the grounds that p is an equilibrium point. So nothing should be changing there. So the area should, so the expansion and shear should vanish. But then now we realize that's incorrect. Because since an infinite amount of killing time flows as you approach p, as long as things are changing at a finite rate with respect to, let's say, a proper time, they're automatically changing at 0 rate with respect to killing time. So equilibrium by itself does not say that sigma must vanish, but this argument says that sigma must vanish. So considering then those horizons for which sigma vanishes, and I'll come back to the I'll come back to this condition in a moment, I infer that I kill off this term. The Ricci tensor contracted twice with k must be proportional to the stress energy tensor contracted twice with k. So I get the Einstein equation up to a tensor proportional to the metric. I can't determine the tensor proportional to the metric because when I contract that with a null vector twice, I get 0 anyway. So I get the trace-free Einstein equation only, everything but the trace, with a Newton constant, if you trace it through, that's equal to 1 over 4 h bar a. Then to get the trace part of the Einstein equation, I haven't used energy conservation yet. You might have noted. And remember the analogy with the ideal gas law. We have to combine the Clausius relation with the first law of thermodynamics. Somewhere energy conservation entered the argument. And so far, I haven't used energy conservation anywhere. I still got the trace-free Einstein equation, but I didn't get the whole thing. If I now impose that the energy momentum tensor of the matter that I've put into the heat flow is divergence-free, that's local energy conservation, I can then infer that the undetermined part of the Einstein equation, that is the trace part, must just be given by a constant, lambda times the metric. And that's an undetermined cosmological constant in the derivation. So this is the basis of my claim that there is no way to avoid the conclusion, given thermodynamics, that the low energy Newton constant we actually see in nature is precisely related to the universal entropy density of horizons by this formula.
You know that Carnot didn't use the conservation of energy to get the entropy.
You don't need it to get the existence of the entropy.
And then he went on top of it, and then he died. But he was going to use the conservation of energy and to get the equation of state of ideal gases.
Tell me that story later. Okay, now let me come back, and this I find fascinating, partly because it's the last, most recent thing I've looked at on this. I come back to the question about the shear here. You see, if it's really true that the system is in equilibrium and Clausius relationship holds, I shouldn't have the freedom to only consider local causal horizons whose shear happens to vanish. Right? I mean, it's not, if it's really thermodynamics, it's thermodynamics. So what about that shear? So I have to consider the shear viscosity of the horizon. If the shear doesn't vanish, then what we figured out is that means we shouldn't be imposing the Clausius relation anyway. You see, the point P is an equilibrium point, but as we flow into P, we're just approaching equilibrium. And you know that in a system that's near equilibrium, if you have gradients in the border parameter or whatever, in the classical variables that describe the flow, that leads to a rate of dissipation or internal energy entropy production, labeled here D sub I of S. That stands for internal. So the actual Clausius relation that we need to use is that the entropy change is the heat flux in divided by T plus any internal entropy production. Now, we first thought of this in the context of adding higher curvature terms and became terrified that we have no idea. How do you figure out what the internal entropy production rate is for one of these things? But, you know, in the context of non-equilibrium thermodynamics, it's almost a universal thing. The form of an internal entropy production is a square of your inhomogeneity quantity divided by temperature times some phenomenological coefficient. It just always has to have that form. And so, in fact, if we were talking about a fluid, this would be precisely the form of entropy production rate per unit time, per unit, well, it would be volume in that case, but I'm writing area for the horizon. It would have exactly this form where what is this letter? Zeta is the shear viscosity. I've put a hat on here because the time that appears in this formula is the time whose conjugate Hamiltonian is the one in which characterizes the equilibrium state. Whereas my sigma, as I previously referred to, was measured as the rate of shear with respect to affine parameter. So I have to correct for that first before I try to compare this formula. So this is derivative with respect to affine parameter. I then multiply by derivative of affine parameter with respect to killing time, and I get what I'm calling sigma hat. So if I simply postulate this is, as it always is, the rate of internal entropy production, I find that that will precisely cancel this term. Because look, it's sigma sigma, provided I identify the shear viscosity in the appropriate way. So what is that way? It should be eta, the universal entropy density, times the temperature over 2. Or in other words, h bar 8 over 4 pi, or in terms of Newton's constant, 1 over 16 pi g. This is exactly the shear viscosity of the horizon inferred by Thorne and Price and Thorne in the membrane paradigm of black hole thermodynamics, looking at the horizon as a fluid with various material properties. They inferred essentially by a very closely related analysis, but obviously not the same because I don't have a black hole here, that a black hole horizon has this shear viscosity. But I've inferred here that that any local causal horizon has the same shear viscosity. Okay, I just said that part. There's a bit of a puzzle at first. You know, a shear viscosity, what determines the shear viscosity of a fluid? It's the microscopic structure and interactions of the fluid. So how is it that we're able to calculate, ideally in sort of close form, the shear viscosity of this system? And the answer is, well, we're not really, because the answer comes out proportional to eta. And eta is the universal entropy density, is 100% phenomenological. We have no theory of eta. I just postulated it at the beginning. So in fact, the shear viscosity is phenomenological. But it's still puzzling, maybe, that it's perfectly proportional to the entropy density. The ratio of shear viscosity to entropy density is universal. And why is that? I think I'll skip this blah blah so I can get on to some other things. I especially want to mention this, though. Recent work by Paula Castro, Sohn, and Starnetz in the context of ADS-CFT duality derived exactly this relation in the following setting. You have a supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. They consider it in a thermal state. The plasma has some shear viscosity, but according to the ADS-CFT duality, this plasma is dual to a gravitational configuration of a black hole in anti-de Sitter space. And using that duality, they could calculate, using the microscopic formula, Kubo formula, for the shear viscosity in terms of stress tensor correlation functions, they could relate that to a scattering amplitude of gravitons on the black hole background. And when they did so, they came up with a number for the shear viscosity of this Yang-Mills supersymmetric Yang-Mills plasma. And it was precisely the same as I found here, universal ratio of shear viscosity to entropy density. So according to my perspective, the reason that works I mean, according to my perspective, what this shows is that these people that claim that the gauge theory is really dual to a gravity theory are right. So anyway, that's an amazing thing. This I'll skip very quickly. We considered in our recent work, what about if the entropy density has corrections that do depend on the radius of curvature? We considered a simple class of such corrections that's polynomial on the Ricci scale. And we showed that actually, once again, we could derive the Einstein equation. But in this case, the equilibrium required that the area not be constant at p, so the expansion had to be non-zero. And that required introduction of now a bulk viscosity in addition to the shear viscosity. And I think I'll just skip that and invite you to look at the paper if that sounds interesting. So I want to get to sort of what does it all mean, or at least, yeah. So, it looks like we've shown that any theory that has local Poincaré invariance, and that's, I invoke that to get the Unruh effect, the thermal nature of the vacuum, on a positive energy condition that actually underlies this Bissignano-Wickman theorem, that it must have gravity. In other words, I'm not allowed to consider a world without gravity. How could that possibly be that I just showed you that there must be gravity in the world? I mean, couldn't we just write down a relativistic quantum field theory in Minkowski space that has no gravity? And the answer is, yes, we could. But remember, if you do that, that quantum field theory will have an infinite entropy density. So when you run this argument, you'll find out that Newton's constant is zero for that theory. So it has no gravity. So that's consistent. But still, if you think somebody, I mentioned this argument, and somebody once in the audience of another talk pointed out quite rightly, but doesn't the argument still imply in that case that the vacuum Einstein equation must solve? So if you turn off G, you still have Ricci tensor equals zero. And I hope it doesn't imply that, because I can always consider quantum field theory in a curved, fixed curved background that's not Ricci flat. Why can't I consider that? So what breaks down in my argument there? And here I have not as good an answer. The best I can come up with is this. If we're talking now about a relativistic quantum field theory, so we have infinite entropy density. And maybe when the entropy density is infinite, I can't really apply the Clausius relation, even with an internal entropy production, because I'm comparing infinity with infinity. And that's the best I can come up with to say why my argument doesn't apply. But it better not apply. Okay, so can we test this idea? And what do I mean by that?
Can I ask something else?
Yes.
So you're arguing that you have to have gravity, but it's more than that. You have to have gravity as described by Einstein's theory.
Right.
Which is a much stronger.
Do
you have any way of, like, I mean, Brunsicki theory, what's black holes, and presumably all of that applies to?
Well, that's the part I skipped over quickly. The only thing I can tell you that I've actually looked at is what if the entropy density, once you've assumed the entropy is just proportional to the area, you get Einstein gravity. If you allow some other function that the entropy is in, then you get a different equation of state. So we showed that you could get the higher derivative corrections to Einstein gravity by including higher derivative corrections to the entropy, well, some derivative corrections, the Ricci scalar. And it's an interesting question how widely you could follow that path. Like, could you get Brunsicki? Could you get Lovelock gravity? You know, we only consider a polynomial in the Ricci scalar.
I hope you like the idea that the Nobel gravity is unstable. Put some curvature in it, put some metric in. It curves as little as you like. And then do your field theory that you will induce curvature when you renormalize, and you get induced gravity from zero-point effects.
So you're saying actually,
if you're finding an unstable situation.
So is your point that mathematically pure quantum field theory in a fixed background is from a physical point of view?
In fixed flat?
That's maybe. Okay, good. So what I mean by testing, what, you sure you want to ask a question? What I mean by testing the idea is what I did was assume from the outset that the entropy is proportional to the area and deduce the Einstein equation and the relation between Newton's constant and the entropy density. Could we find a situation where we can actually calculate the entanglement entropy and the induced Newton constant and see if it really works that way? That's a pretty tall order because we don't have quantum gravity here. But coming again to ADS-CFT, we do have actually in ADS-CFT a knowledge of the quantum gravity theory reduced to a non-gravitational theory. Remember, the conformal field theory has no gravity in it, and it's dual to quantum string theory, which includes gravity. So in that context, however, the CFT is it's just on a fixed background and there's no gravity, so I can't test the idea. It has no cutoff. The conformal field theory has an infinite number of degrees of freedom. It has an infinite entanglement entropy. However, people have considered fairly recently the situation where instead of putting the boundary, the conformal field theory at the infinite boundary of anti-de Sitter space, it's put at a finite location. And one imagines a kind of brain there. I think, I don't know this field very well, but it's called the Randall-Sundrum brain. And then the theory on that surface at a finite location is dual to the bulk theory on the inside. And it turns out that that theory, the field theory at the finite ADS radius, it has evidently both Poincaré invariance and an ultraviolet cutoff in some appropriate sense that I don't really understand myself, except that I think it's that if you go up to too high an energy, fields sort of leak off the brain. You can no longer analyze the system as being confined to the brain. And this theory, indeed, so it has a cutoff, so it has a finite entropy. So according to me, it better have gravity. And indeed, it has gravity. And people are able to calculate both the entanglement entropy and the induced Newton constant in this theory and see how it scales with n, which is the number of colors in the Yang-Mills theory, and the cutoff. And sure enough, the entanglement entropy and the induced Newton constant are related in just the way they're supposed to be. This was first looked at by Hawking, Molisane, and Strominger in a case of two-dimensional field theory. And Roberto Emperon this year actually extended it to higher dimensions. So in that sense, it can be tested. I'm out of time for this. I'm going to skip the implications for Hawking radiation, unfortunately, and just go to the summary. So what did I say? Black hole entropy has little to do with black holes. It's really a property of causal horizons. The equation of state of vacuum thermodynamics of causally defined regions is the Einstein equation with Newton's constant, the inverse of the universal entanglement entropy density. Horizon shear entails entropy production, and the ratio of shear viscosity to entropy density is universal. Curvature corrections, this is the part I didn't explain in detail, also entail entropy production. That's the bulk viscosity I mentioned. And what I was going to say about Hawking radiation is that the existence of Hawking radiation and the corresponding entropy implies that mode conversion must take place to supply the outgoing modes in the absence of a Trans-Planckian reservoir. And the reason there's no Trans-Planckian reservoir is that if there were, the entropy wouldn't be finite. So I can't explain that now. I just want to end with what is the message? I started by saying, what is the message? Okay, so what is the message? I don't know. I really don't know, okay? I'm sorry. But I felt like if I'm going to ask you to sit here for an hour and listen to me, I should just try my best. So this is my best guess at what your message is. First of all, gravity implies that there is a UV cutoff. Okay? People have for years wondered, maybe quantum gravity cuts off the divergences by some grace of God. I'm saying it's by the necessity of thermodynamics, there's a UV cutoff. The universality of entropy area density is a feature of whatever quantum gravity vacuum ends up being the right theory. And so we conclude, since the Einstein equation is an equation of state of thermodynamics, that gravity is thermodynamics. But this is puzzling, because we also know that gravity is a quantum field. We can write the action, we vary it, we quantize the perturbations, we've even seen them effectively, presumably in the cosmic microwave background, the effect of quantized gravity fluctuations, the scalar mode. So it's thermodynamics, but it's also quantized. Doesn't that contradict? Don't these things contradict each other? So the best example I could think of so far is second sound in helium 2. This is an excitation of the ground state of liquid helium, superfluid helium, in which there's an entropy wave or a thermal excitation, but at the same time a disturbance of the superfluid condensate in such a way that the mass density of the fluid is unperturbed, and there's a kind of coherent oscillation of the thermal state of the normal fluid and the superfluid component. And I just asked Robert Kraut at lunch whether, is it true that those second sound waves are quantum quasi-particles, excitations of the fluid? And he said to me, it must be, I hope you're willing to stand behind this, it must be, because if it wasn't, given that these interact with other components of the fluid, the canonical commutation relations of the quantized part would be destroyed. It wouldn't be a consistent system if this excitation, which does touch the other ones, was not quantized. So best I can think is this is sort of analogous. It's somehow at the same time a thermal excitation and it is quantum. And and that's the way we have to think about the vacuum in quantum gravity. I'll just stop there.
I seem to recall that some intrinsic problems to do with induced gravity, although I was speaking out of it, trying to calculate the gravitational constant. In fact, it has a lot of sign. And no one's ever been able to solve that problem as far as I know. However, you're saying that we have to do this. My second question is, you made the statement that we see quantum gravity in the CMB. I don't. What do you mean by that? I didn't think we see quantum gravity anyway.
Well, maybe Robert, who's sitting next to you, can correct me if I'm wrong. But the modes whose perturbations we do see the effect of are coupled inflaton scalar metric perturbation modes.
Okay, I'll disappoint you here. I'm going to show that they actually. Classical string thermodynamic fluctuations, which have nothing to do with inflation.
Okay.
So, the observations.
Then I retract that statement.
So, no, induced gravity. What's the story of that? There's been problems with that.
Yeah, people try to set up induced gravity in a well-defined field theory framework. And you're right, every attempt has failed for one reason or another. So, but the supposition that this should be possible within the framework of field theory is not justified. So, that's the best I can give you as an answer. I can't write a self-contained quantum field theory because the fields are describing low energy effective degrees of freedom that aren't the appropriate language to properly formulate what the true nature of this relation between the entropy and the, what determines the entropy. The field degrees of freedom are not the right language. I guess that's what I infer from it.
Just a point to clarify, Robert, would you agree that it doesn't have to retract the statement, right? You're just saying that if you don't believe in the equation and come up with another theory, then you can give a different explanation of what was going on, what we are seeing in the CMD. But within inflation, it was right.
Yeah, but I was making the claim, the statement that we have already seen the effects of quantum gravity, and Robert's saying, you know, maybe what we're seeing is explained in this other way.
I disagree with that statement.
Would you elaborate on your statement that you don't need a Transrankine reservoir just to make Hawking photons? And when you know that, when you extrapolate backwards, you go into the Transrankine
right
distance.
Okay, the logic
horizon.
Is, I'm inferring that you must not need one. Okay, so here's the reasoning. Given that I've inferred that the entropy must be finite, the number of degrees of freedom must be finite. But in the standard picture of where the Hawking radiation comes from, it comes from this infinitely deep Transplanckian reservoir at the horizon, which would carry an infinite or entropy way above the one that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy gives. So if I'm saying that I'm convinced that that reservoir is not there because it would have contributed too much entropy, then I have to explain to you where the hell the Hawking radiation comes from.
Yeah,
right, so I'm just saying, I'm inferring, it must be that these modes that are the outgoing modes near the horizon are produced by some form of what I call mode conversion. They're sucked out of the vacuum, or they're created, or they're turned around from ingoing modes. There are models in free field theory with dispersion where you can kind of see ways of producing modes that are coming away from horizons that didn't start there. Those are just toy models. It occurred to me in writing this that given that the ADS-CFT duality has done so much for us, maybe we can ask it to do more. Think about a black hole on the Randall-Sundrum brain, which has a cutoff, presumably has no Transplanckian reservoir that's infinitely deep at the horizon, and ask in that setting, how does that black hole on that brain come up with its outgoing modes? So there should be some mechanism, maybe according like what Renaud was talking about in actually his talk on expanding cosmology, that the modes somehow come from the extra dimensions in that model. And it would be great to see that explicitly if you possibly could. I don't know. I'm just inferring that they must come from somewhere else.
If the black hole collapses, and if it makes available to our space one Planckian unit around its surface, and you believe in the graininess of the underlying space, aren't you liberating space and therefore making available the reservoir of the mode that you need? We have a black hole. So we are limiting the space available to us from the horizon of the black hole. And then there's a self-consistent process, which I envisage, in which the horizon is beginning to fluctuate, a little space gets available, and it makes a grain.
Space that used to
be
inside?
For us.
You mean space that used to be inside the horizon? Or a new piece of space?
I only know the space I see, which is virtual space. I can't see inside.
All right.
So my space increases by one Planckian unit.
Yeah.
It's available to me now. It didn't used to be available.
Right.
It's a self-consistent process. So I can make a mode from that reservoir, which
maybe.
What you like. It's now available to me. It's a self-consistent process. The shrinking and the liberation go together.
Yeah, it sounds nice. I'd like to see it fleshed out. I don't know how to describe that.
That's the concept of a reservoir. It's because the horizon that's hidden, what I can't get hold of. But once I can, then it manifests itself in my world.
Maybe. Oh, it's a nice idea.
Okay, so this is a question about fluctuations. So if you have a box of gas, it's all that deep people's energy is not really true, and you have fluctuations of pressure and so on. Do you have any handle on doing this analogous thing for gravity? So you have some fluctuations around, so you have fluctuations in the metric and so on.
I haven't thought about it, but it's a good question. If we have take seriously this thermal state that the whole thing is built around, one knows something about those fluctuations, and maybe you can get some mileage out of that.
Yeah, the variance, I mean, presumably
I don't know. I've never seen anybody try to do that. People have talked about black hole fluctuations in a kind of global sense, but I like the idea of looking at them locally. Maybe you could do something.
So in your derivation, basically it seems that you're taking the Beckett-Hawking relation as fundamental, but that's just a semi-classical result. You know that.
I'm taking as fundamental the proportionality.
Well, then you, in the entropy density, you could zero slider curvature corrections. But at the beginning, it seems like the Beckett-Hawking relation for you is just fundamental, right? So you're not considering the possibility of quantum gravity corrections.
No, it's phenomenological. Maybe you're slightly, when you say fundamental, don't forget.
Well, fundamental, in some way.
But I think it's crucial that the coefficient is purely phenomenological in my viewpoint. I'm not tying it to Newton's constant at the starting point.
It's I'm talking about the functional dependence of the entropy.
Right. That's just the lowest term in some
expansion,
but it's the dominating term because the Planck length is so small.
So you think your derivation can still hold when you have higher order Planck corrections to this entropy relation?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. We've shown it works if you add, for example, the only case I know is a polynomial in the Ricci scalar.
Right. Yeah, but you didn't mention any link with quantum gravity or anything when you said higher order.
Well, quantum gravity, presumably the Einstein-Hilbert term is just the lowest order term in quantum gravity effect of
that. Yeah, and I'm saying that might be related also to the appearance of logarithmic terms in the entropy area relation. Like the ones you see in middle quantum gravity, for example. When you count the
Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if those logarithmic corrections are related to terms in the effect of action in any.
Well, and what I'm saying is that it might be a way to link.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Aspects, right?
Yeah.
Yes? Well, okay. I think there's a problem with the logarithmic correction because don't you have to assume that it's part of the assumption is that it's local, right? You equate those two fingerprints. It has to be something over the surface. Whereas the log of the area.
Well, you're assuming basically that you're extending from like a black hole to any causal horizon. So
No, you're right. That's going to be. Also, actually, it should be remembered that log correction is so tiny that it's completely dependent on the precise ensemble that you take for the equilibrium. Don Page emphasized this in his review article on black hole thermodynamics, and he calculated for a bunch of different ensembles how the corrections change and identified how ambiguous they are. So there's sort of a global issue that's raised before you can make sense of that kind of a correction.
If I can come back to my earlier question, so I might be wrong, but my reflection is that if you take Brand Speaking theory and look at its black hole solutions, I think that that Schwarzschild black hole is a solution to the Brensky.
Yes, it is.
So assuming this, and assuming that while you get the same entropy relation for a Schwarzschild black hole in Brensky theory, if you start from the entropy result and work out what the third equations have to be, you'll get the wrong answer. Because your route leads to Einstein, not Brensky. So I'm wondering what the whole is.
I suspect we can actually pick up the Brensky we may have to start more. One issue that's going to arise is the Brown-Stickey field contributing to the heat flow that appears in the Clausius relation or not? And that may depend on what we want to think of as the length scale of the Brown-Stickey field. And if it's long compared, if it's of the same order as the radius of curvature of the space-time, then for the purpose of my argument, it may as well be a constant. So then the question would just be, can I admit a constant appropriately in what I'm doing? But the answer is yes, of course, because I just had a phenomenological constant anyway. So we could talk about it and see if it's if there's a problem with that. It's not clear to me that there's...
You might have to, I mean, you have to find good definitions for heat, good definitions for local entropy reduction, and there's a danger that you might always tune your definitions to suit the result.
Yeah. Yeah, we have thought about that some, and I don't have anything really good to say, but I would like to talk with you about it. You could always make a field redefinition and get rid of the Brown-Stickey field and the entropy. Just include the corresponding resulting scalar field that's in your heat current, and then, of course, you get the correct field equation. But is that something you have to know in advance that you should do that, or can we argue that it's somehow inevitable according to this philosophy? I don't know.
I just had one quick question. So when you use energy conservation to figure out what the trace part of the trace equation is, and it was still a few parameter, which is lambda.
Yeah.
So is there anything one could say about how lambda relates to G?
From this point of view, I can see no way to say anything. Completely undetermined in the usual sense. I might be wrong, but seen other people try to determine it but not succeed.